from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Yesterday, two journalists for San Francisco-based Current TV went on trial in North Korea. At least, we think they went on trial. So pervasive is the secrecy that envelops that country that nobody really knows for sure what's taking place. In our first half hour on Forum this morning, we'll do our best to assess what's going on for the two journalists and how their fate plays into the tense relations between North Korea, its neighbors, and the United States. And then at 9:30, we'll turn our attention to a controversy in our own backyard, the possibility that the San Francisco 49ers will soon call Santa Clara home. A North Korea update and a stadium update. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In Pyongyang, North Korea, it is now 1:06 a.m. on Saturday morning. But even if it were the middle of the day, we probably would not know what was happening to American journalists Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, the two reporters for San Francisco-based Current TV who were arrested near the North Korea-China border in March and are now charged with engaging in so-called hostile acts. They were supposed to go on trial yesterday. But what happened, if anything, is a mystery. The uncertain fate of the two American journalists is playing out at a time of renewed tension between the United States and North Korea. In fact, last week's nuclear test angered not only the U.S., but South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia. And so in this first half hour of Forum this morning, we're going to do our best to see if we can part the curtains even just a little and get a sense of what may be going on in this most secretive of lands. Joining us first, Bob Dietz. He's with the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is an organization that defends the rights of reporters around the world. He's also a former Seoul, South Korea bureau chief for NBC News. Bob Dietz, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Steve.
What's the latest? Do you know anything at all about what's gone on over the last 24 to 36 hours?
No, in so many words. There was a trial that was supposed to start June 4th in Pyongyang time. There was even a start time given by KCNA, the Korean Central News Agency, the government's propaganda arm. And that, as far as we can tell, a trial hasn't started.
Hmm.
The one thing we do know is that the Swedish ambassador who has been visiting the women and representing the United States was told that it would be a closed trial and he wouldn't be allowed to attend.
I know you've been in touch with the family, at least the Ling family. Have you been able to glean from Laura Ling's sister at all any sense about how the two American journalists are faring?
Yes. They've been very frank, frankly. They've been making a lot of public statements, and they've told us privately as well, that as far as they can tell, the women aren't being abused. They're being held in a guest house or what amounts to a hotel outside of Pyongyang. They're being separated from each other. In their communications, they're both expressing a great deal of concern. I would assume there's some sort of psychological pressure being put on them. But it doesn't sound like they're being physically abused or tortured, as, say, the crew from the Pueblo was in 1968. I think the sense I get is that North Korea has a sense of the value of these women and isn't about to play that game with them.
As you noted, the families have been more public. There have been vigils held around the country, actually around the world, over the last 48 hours or so. But until then, the families had been quiet, as has Current TV here in San Francisco, as has the State Department, in a sense. Is it your understanding that the sort of overall strategy in all of this, on the part of at least both the families and the government here in the United States, is that keeping this low-key and quiet is what's in the best interests of the two journalists?
I think that's certainly the State Department's attitude, and I think Current TV is following their lead. You know, Current former Vice President
right.
Al Gore was involved in founding Current, so we would assume that. The families told us that the State Department had encouraged them to keep a low low-level, low-profile. And I think they did up until this weekend, or last weekend, rather. And then they had a very well-devised rollout plan of making a very personal humanitarian appeal directed toward the North Korean government. They used the NBC Today show and Larry King Live very specifically because we've been told and understand that it's true that most media is very closely monitored, but in North Korea by the government, and that these two shows in particular are watched. The family decided to use those two venues to speak directly to the government and make a direct humanitarian appeal. They realize they're caught up in you know, much larger issues on the Korean Peninsula that have been going on for decades. And what they're trying to do is break the situation, the case of these two women, out of that larger geopolitical context.
And just a last quick thought, Bob Dietz, from your point of view as someone engaged in an effort to protect journalists around the globe, does that strategy still make sense to you of keeping this low-key on the part of the government? And what, if anything, do you think can be done to protect journalists? What would you advocate that other journalists do in terms of drawing attention or not drawing attention to this kind of situation?
David, each one of these situations is different. You know, everyone is drawing a parallel to Roxana Seberian
and
her detention in Iran. Iran is not North Korea. There's a whole different set of issues being discussed. The tensions and the very nature of the governments with that you're dealing with are different. We look back. We've been involved in about. Well, scores is the best estimate we can come up with. Scores of these sort of cases over the years. And what we found is virtually each and every one is different in some way. We've seen information completely suppressed. We've seen employers and families launch immediate international campaigns. If you recall, a year or two ago, there was a BBC producer held in Gaza. BBC helped organize street demonstrations calling for his release and went very, very public. Gaza is not North Korea. North Korea is not Iran. And each one of these, I think you have to proceed uniquely.
Bob Dietz, who's with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Bob, thanks very much for giving us your insights on the situation this morning.
Thanks very much, David.
Joining us now to continue our conversation, Paul Leem, who chairs the Korea Policy Institute, which is a research and policy institution that focuses on relationships between the United States and North and South Korea. Mr. Leem, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you with us. Victor Cha joins us as well. He is associate professor and director of Asian Studies in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He also served as director of Asian Affairs for the National Security Council between 2004 and 2007. Professor Cha, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's put this trial, if we can, in something of a context. Paul Leem, first, how do you see the significance of this trial, not only, of course, for the safety and security of the two journalists, but what role it plays, if any, in the current tensions between North Korea and the United States?
Well, I certainly hope that the reporters are released and returned to their families as soon as possible. There's some indication that Al Gore, you know, may go to North Korea to seek their release, and I certainly hope something like this can occur. In terms of the larger tensions stemming from the nuclear test last week, I think it's important to realize that, you know, at this time, North Korea and the United States not only do not have any diplomatic relations or normalized relations, but they are actually in a state of war. I think it's important to realize that although we have a free press in this country, from the point of view of the North Koreans, the role of the press in the United States with regard to U.S.-Korea policy is no different than U.S.-Korea policy itself. So the trial of these reporters for reasons which we would normally not considered to be valid reasons from the point of North Korea, insofar as they believe that the press is an arm of isolating them in the sanctions places these women also in a very difficult spot.
And so they see those reporters perhaps as agents of the government. Victor Cha, how do you see this right now? And what, if you can, give us what insight you might have about the way in which the North Korean government might view this trial and these two journalists as being useful to them during this tension-filled time?
Well, I don't know if there is any direct relationship between the current crisis with regard to their ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons program, the UN Security Council resolution being negotiated in New York, and the taking of these two journalists. If anything, probably the way the North Korean government is looking at this is in terms of what they see as another very grave threat to their system, which is the fact that people are voting with their feet and trying to leave the country, refugees trying to cross the border into China and leave the country. And in that sense, I think if they're looking at any particular political message with regard to these journalists, it would be to send the message that they don't like this. They don't like people coming in trying to report on stories about how people are trying to leave North Korea, whether that's on the border or in China. They don't like that. So that would be the main political context in which they would do this. Having said that, I remain hopeful that after they sentence these people, there will be an opportunity for the North to show, you know, some magnanimity on their part and release them to anybody who would go over, some high-level envoy who would go over there to retrieve them.
Victor Cha is at Georgetown University, where he chairs, directs the Asian Studies program in the School of Foreign Service. He also was the Director of Asian Affairs for the National Security Council between 2004 and 2007. We welcome your calls and thoughts, too, on this subject. If you have a question about what's going on with either the journalists or our overall situation between the United States and North Korea, you can give us a call now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Victor Cha, in terms of, you mentioned what's going on right now in New York with the United Nations resolution. How do you see what may be framed right now? Do you sense a real difference this time that it is not just the United States, Japan, and South Korea, for example, that feel strongly about this, but that China and Russia may go along as well with putting forward additional sanctions?
I do think that that is the case. The thing that was different about the recent provocations by North Korea is that it was very difficult for analysts or commentators to blame U.S. policy for North Korean provocations. In the past, often the reaction was to blame the Bush administration for its, you know, unwillingness to talk to North Korea as the reason that the North was undertaking these acts. The Obama administration came in and sent very clear signals at the very beginning of its willingness to pick up the six-party process and the agreements and to move forward, including high-level bilateral talks with the North Koreans, and yet the North did the things that they've done. So I think there's a great deal of solidarity among the six-party members as well as the members of the Permanent Five in the UN Security Council to seek another UN Security Council resolution in addition to the one that was passed after the October 2006 nuclear test. And I would imagine that resolution will not only be unanimous, but it will have some pretty tough sanctions associated with it as a way to try to send a message to North Korea that it can't continue to test missiles over the home islands of Japan or to test nuclear weapons in a way that's quite destabilizing to the region.
And Paul Lehm, the question then becomes whether or not an additional resolution would be useful in having North Korea abide by some of those international concerns, or whether or not additional sanctions will push North Korea even further in the opposite direction. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think it's quite clear that they've made very clear that they would consider additional sanctions on the part of the United Nations to be an abrogation of the armistice agreement, insofar as the UN was the signatory to that agreement. I think also the solidarity that Dr. Cha is referring to in the Security Council is not really shaping up. It's been 2 weeks since the nuclear blast has occurred, and there is no draft of the resolution being presented. And according to Global Security Newswire, which is a news service of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, actually Russia and China are urging that the United Nations Security Council offer to drop sanctions if North Korea would agree to a moratorium on its missile ban. So actually, there's quite a bit of contention in the Security Council now about a resolution.
So you're dubious both about whether or not a tougher resolution will go forward, but it also sounds like you're dubious about its value, that you think, in fact, that it could be counterproductive. Is that right?
The entire heart of the matter for North Korea is really its relationship with the United States and whether or not it feels the United States is willing to accept a state of coexistence with it. The pursuit of the complete and verifiable, irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's weapons as a precondition for normalizations was the holy grail of the Bush administration policy on North Korea. And it was a fantasy. It was a very dangerous fantasy. It resulted in North Korea going nuclear, and it is at the root of the instability in Asia now.
Victor Cha, it becomes a kind of chicken and egg question in a certain sense. Do you give recognition and therefore hope that that will spur further a denuclearization, or does it go the other way around, that you have to give up your nuclear power before we will recognize you? How do you see that?
Well, a couple of things. The first is that although there may have been some rhetoric in the first term of the Bush administration about the need for North Korea to disarm before anything else would happen, in practice that was not the case. As we saw, a series of agreements were reached that made substantial progress towards disabling North Korea's nuclear capabilities, and they got stuff in return for that. The question of peaceful coexistence and the desire for a security guarantee have all been enumerated in something called the Six-Party Joint Statement, in which it says very clearly that the United States will not attack North Korea with nuclear or conventional weapons. With regard to the chicken and egg question, I certainly do appreciate the dilemma, having participated in the negotiations personally, about whether you can move down a normalization process as they do denuclearize, or whether you need them to denuclearize completely before you even discuss normalization. Personally, I'm of the view that it has to be the former, that you can start a process and you need to show them your interest in normalization at the same time as a process of denuclearization moves forward. I think it's very difficult for the United States simply to say, fine, we'll sign a peace treaty with you, we'll normalize relations with you, and then we'll do this first, and then we'll start your process of denuclearization. And the reason I think that's difficult is that the United States does not operate in Asia in a vacuum. It has allies, particularly in South Korea and Japan. And if the United States were to, in this case, put the normalization egg before the chicken being denuclearization, it would raise all sorts of concerns, I think, in Tokyo and Seoul about whether we had resigned ourselves to accept a nuclear weapon state in North Korea.
Victor Cha joining us this morning from Georgetown University, along with Paul Leem, who directs and chairs the Korea Policy Institute. If you want to get in a quick question to either of our guests, we're just spending our first half hour on this topic, this first hour of forum, so you have time to do so. But get in a call now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Paul Leem, one of the things that's been being talked about now in terms of additional teeth, perhaps, is that in the first resolution that was passed by the United Nations, it authorized the possibility of inspections. One of the concerns that's been raised of ships leaving or coming into North Korea is not so much whether or not North Korea would launch a nuclear weapon, but whether or not it would sell that technology, trade that technology elsewhere. And so there's this power to inspect. Hasn't happened. Do you think that should go forward, or do you also feel that that would further aggravate and alienate the situation?
I think the idea that North Korea would sell its nuclear weapons or its fissile material to foreign countries reflects a complete misunderstanding of why the North Koreans developed these weapons in the first place. They do develop missiles for commercial sale. Their missiles are a source of foreign exchange for them. They make no bones about that, and they have even offered to sell them to the United States. The nuclear weapons are very special to them. These weapons, they have developed for the specific purpose of providing a deterrent to what they feel is hostility from the United States. Now, remember, the Bush administration did target them for a preemptive nuclear strike. We have never taken that off the table. North Korea is still faced with a nuclear umbrella of the United States and Asia. So this is a situation which, you know, the North Koreans take very seriously.
I want to hear your view on that as well, Victor Cha, but let's first get in a couple of quick calls, if we can, in the short time that we have. Phil in Burlingame wants to raise a question. Phil, go ahead.
Hi. It's kind of a strange question, but everybody's, you know, talking about dealing with North Korea, but they don't seem to ever negotiate in good faith. They're about to get a third dictator in position. I mean, what about the idea of a preemptive strike into them, a decapitating strike? Are they really as militarily powerful as everyone says? They've got no commerce.
Phil, thanks for the
answer.
Yeah, Phil, thanks for the question. Victor Cha, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it's the policy dilemma with regard to the North Korea and the Korean Peninsula is that there aren't really any good military options. The notion of a preemptive strike, the United States could carry one out. The problem is the level of retaliation by the North could wreak all sorts of havoc on Seoul. There are thousands of North Korean long-range artillery tubes that sit along the demilitarized zone that are within minutes of population centers in downtown Seoul as well as U.S. bases. And that makes it very difficult to contemplate any sort of military action, and why every single administration for the past 16 years has resigned itself to some form of negotiation and diplomacy with the North.
Let's get in one more quick question. David in San Leandro. Go ahead, please. David, I'm sorry, we just have a moment. So quick question.
Yes, I was wondering if the guests could summarize whether both sides have actually lived up to the agreements that have been made in the recent period, and how does the Korean War sort of figure in as a backdrop to all this?
Somehow, I don't think we're going to be able to formulate a thorough response to that in the last minute that we have. But Pauline, first, just a quick response and thought, and then Victor Cha.
Let me just say that from the North Koreans' point of view, the dialogue with the United States has been a process or a goal for them to achieve normalization of relations. From the point of view of the United States, the dialogues have been for the purpose of disarming North Korea's nuclear weapons. The United States was not willing to offer this without North Korea giving up firsts. North Korea will not give up firsts as long as the United States is pressuring them, and this is a result of distrust stemming from the Korean War. That war has to end.
Victor Cha.
Well, I can certainly empathize with that viewpoint, but I think at the same time it's been fairly clear that successive administrations have offered deals to North Korea in which there have been material things put on the table, and the North doesn't seem to be very interested. It's interested for a period of time, and then it doesn't seem to be interested after that. Normalization in exchange for denuclearization, I think any U.S. administration would take that deal. The problem is I don't think the North Koreans would take that deal. For the North Koreans, normalization is a piece of paper, and they would be giving up nuclear weapons for that.
We have to leave it there. Thanks for at least giving us a glimpse into some of the controversial and intense and complicated dilemmas that are before us as we go forward, both for the journalists and for North Korea. Victor Cha from Georgetown University, Pauline from the Korea Policy Institute. Thanks both very much for being part of our program. When we come back, we'll turn to a controversy in our own backyard about the San Francisco 49ers and where they should call home. That's coming up in just a moment.